This is The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
My name is Toby Halligan and this is The Informer. Thank you very much to Nick for that delightful little news break. And Nick is joining us here in the studio along with Sai Shri on for this episode of The Informer. This is a special episode dedicated to Ida Hobbit Day, which will be held tomorrow. Ida Hobbit Day, for those of you who don't know, is a celebration of inclusion that focuses, it's called International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, Interphobia and Transphobia, that was launched in 2004. The date, May 17th, was specifically chosen to commemorate the World Health Organization's decision in 1990 to declassify homosexuality as a mental disorder. So we'll be speaking to a number of different folks about what Ida Hobbit Day means to them and in some cases what it doesn't mean to them when it comes to the intersex community who do not celebrate it. But obviously, homophobia and other issues continue to be challenges for our community, as was clearly brought to light over the weekend during the Hares and Hyenas raid. Questions remain from that police raid that occurred on 2 a.m. on Saturday night and left Nick Demopoulos with extremely serious injuries to his arm and the entirety of Melbourne's queer community shaken. The widespread community outrage has included multiple ministers, the Premier and senior police. Victoria Police Assistant Commissioner Luke Cornelius was interviewed on Joy, actually, earlier this week, specifically on the show Murphy's Law. Here is some of what he had to say during that interview.
Well, look, I can't go into the details of precisely what happened because, quite rightly, that's the subject of an investigation by our Professional Standards Command, which is being oversighted by IOBAC. But I do want to take the opportunity to one, say, look, absolutely clear to us in Victoria Police that our attendance at the bookshop was a mistake on our part. The arrest of Nick was certainly a mistake on our part. And I'm also very concerned, in fact appalled, by the extent of the injuries that Nick suffered as a result of his engagement with us. So I'm just want to be really clear that Victoria Police is putting its hand up and saying, look, we got that wrong and that we should acknowledge that and say sorry for it. And in fact, I had the opportunity to head out to the Hare and Hound this afternoon and catch up with Roland and Crusader and just pass on to them personally my apologies for what has happened, and also to just touch base with them in relation to finding out how Nick was going.
Yeah, Luke, in regards to that, and obviously there will be a police investigation from this point into the matter, in your opinion, because we were sort of talking about it off air, it seemed like it was an incredibly excessive
use of restraint force. A mistaken identity.
I can provide a bit of context, and I did some of that this morning, but I'm keen to just provide some reassurance to your listeners. Very clear to me from the outset that this was a case of mistaken identity and that this was also a case of a mistaken association of an offender that we were looking for with the address that police entered. And what was happening was our people were in the midst of a very dynamic situation. They were looking for an active offender who'd been engaged in some very serious criminal conduct over the preceding days, including on that night some extremely dangerous driving in a stolen vehicle. So I've got no queries about how police came to be in the vicinity of the Hare and Hound early on Saturday morning. But obviously what transpired from there is and ought to be the subject of rigorous investigation, because the decision to enter the property, the decision then to pursue Nick, and then the way in which he was taken into custody with him suffering such a serious injury, they are all things that quite rightly should be the subject of rigorous investigation, and that is certainly occurring. In fact, just before I came on air to you today, I touched base with Russell Barrett, who runs our Professional Standards Command, and he's confirmed with me that the investigation is proceeding, that IBAC have been notified, and that they're undertaking active oversight in relation to the work that Professional Standards Command have been doing to date.
Okay, well, I think that's what people would be mostly wanting to hear, that this is absolutely going to be investigated, and so that hopefully
we arrest people all the time. On occasion, injuries occur as a result of that. Mm-hmm. I have to say, though, that the seriousness of the injuries in this case are so serious that really we do have to have a long, hard look at exactly what our people did.
That was the Assistant Commissioner, Luke Cornelius, being interviewed on Murphy's Law. It's interesting to note how apologetic the tone of that was, but we do have an update from today that Sai Shree has for us.
The Victorian Police Association Secretary, Wayne Gatt, has told that he was proud of the police officers involved in the Harrison Hyenas raid. Mr. Gatt said many of those who were expressing a view on the case were prejudging the police involved without knowing the full facts. He said the police did everything that was required of them, including announcing themselves as the police, speaking to the occupants of the building, searching the property properly, and engaging with the suspect before the arrest. So there seems to be multiple views on what went down that night, Toby.
Yeah, that's right, because there have been a number of media accounts and accounts indeed quoting other senior police officers that kind of challenge what's being said there. So it's fortunate that there is a review of this case. But there are kind of more complicated factors that feed into incidents like this. Lauren Caulfield works at the Police Accountability Project that's run out of the Flemington and Kensington Community Legal Centre, and I had a chat with her about the history of these kinds of incidents, what drives them here in Melbourne, and I began by asking what her reaction was to the Hare and Hyenas raid.
I think that when you talk about the sort of the shock and the horror and the waves of that reverberating through a community, I think that's absolutely the case. It should be the case. It's understandable that it's the case. Unfortunately, though, I think that to imagine that this is sort of a one-off or it's something that, as Vic Pohl have termed it, they called it a stuff-up, I think that to understand it in those terms would be a really, really grave mistake, because I think that the types of policing that we see in Victoria, unfortunately, this is not a one-off, it's not an exception. What it actually is normal policing that's on display. But in this case, because of the location and the identity of the people at whom the raid was mistakenly targeted, what we've seen is a huge amount of community scrutiny and backlash. We've also seen a huge amount of media interest. And that's not the case when these types of raids are executed all over the place and when they cause really grave harm to people.
Right. So when you say that seems to suggest that these kinds of incidents happen often, can you give us more context on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's often a sort of a continuum of the ways that policing is enacted and the ways that it's experienced. And what we know is that police in Victoria continue to target predominantly young people of colour. We know that they do that at higher rates than they target young white people. And unfortunately, at the Police Accountability Project, we absolutely hear from people who experience this sort of violent policing, and a number of different incidences have come through the clinic that have materially quite similar facts. And often I think that we find when there's a case of what gets described either in the media or by police as mistaken identity, what we're actually talking about is racial profiling and racial targeting. So I think one example that really stands out, because the facts are so similar, is the matter of a previous client who came through the legal centre, and we assisted him with a complaint. And in this case, he was leaving a cafe on Sydney Road with his friends. He'd been drinking coffee. Police had been involved in a car chase. They mistook him for a different brown man that they were pursuing, and they used so much violence in executing this mistaken arrest that they pulled guns on him, they told him to put his hands in the air, and they smashed his face into the pavement with so much force that it broke his jaw and he was knocked unconscious. And at the time, there was no media coverage of that. But the point is that this violence is unacceptable against anybody. And I think one of the really important things to note is that Victoria Police have apologised for the mistaken identity in the raid that they carried out at Hares on the weekend, but they haven't apologised for the tactics or the execution of the raid. And I think that's really telling, because these types of tactics are absolutely par for the course of an organisation that's authorised to use that sort of brutal force against communities.
And so what kind of impact does being subject to that form of policing have on that community?
Well, I think, as you said in the beginning, you know, you've talked about the, I think there are the absolutely, understandably, the traumatic and horrifying impacts on the people who are the target of that violence. So given what happened on the weekend, we've seen a lot of coverage, and there's been a lot of kind of description about the sort of injuries and the horror and the fear that are experienced. And then, of course, there's all of the community ripples of those impacts. And so for communities who are regularly targeted by police, and I'm thinking absolutely of Aboriginal communities, I'm thinking of Black, Indigenous people of colour, communities who are kind of regularly targeted by police, that sort of ongoing fear and then the likelihood of potentially coming into contact with police violence or the violence of policing in that way is a day-to-day reality. You know, it's not the exception. It's not something that's one-off or a stuff-up. It's something that's consistent and ongoing.
And can you just, because I imagine that a lot of our listeners won't necessarily be aware of the scale or what this actually looks like. So if, say, we're talking about, I presume the African community might also be subject to this form of policing. How many kind of raids or arrests, like, can you give us an idea of the scale of it?
Yeah, look, I think that the first thing that you said is so significant, because, of course, this policing doesn't occur in a vacuum. You know, Victoria has been and is in the throes of this sort of manufactured racist crime panic, where despite especially falling youth crime rates, what we're seeing is a huge amount of demonisation of communities, particularly African Australian communities, in the media, and we're seeing that mirrored in the targeting of young people by police. When you ask about the kind of the stats around the types of policing or the levels of these raids, what's really difficult is that in Victoria, we don't have a police force that releases data on the race of the people that they're stopping or the people that they're targeting. That's something that happens in many jurisdictions around the world, but we don't have that, despite that being something that Victoria Police have agreed to as a consequence of a Racial Discrimination Act claim that our legal centre ran some years ago. So what we've got is a police force that continues to target young people of colour. We know that that's the case, even though they won't release data on it. We hear that anecdotally at the legal centre every day. You know, we hear from young people who talk about being stopped by police, and the reason that's given is that they match the description of a suspect. And what's meant by that is it's ethnicity, it's skin colour, and skin colour is not reasonable suspicion. But in terms of actually them being able to get a holistic sense of what the kind of rates are, it makes it very, very difficult. I mean, we hear from people who want to seek accountability or who might want to make a complaint about Victoria Police. We know that the vast majority of complaints about Victoria Police are still returned to the police force for self-investigation. Our legal centre has a 2% substantiation rate on complaints that are made about police when they're self-investigated by police. And those are complaints that are lodged with the assistance of lawyers. So there's already been lawyers in there gathering evidence, assisting somebody to sort of make a case and to lodge that complaint to fullest effect. So that's the situation in Victoria, is that we've got this sort of ridiculously unaccountable system where when police use excessive force, when they racially profile, when they breach people's human rights, then what happens is the matter gets referred back to police and they then investigate themselves.
That sounds like it's a problem where there might be a need for some quite serious reform. So if you had a final kind of takeaway message for our listeners about this incident and what you think it suggests needs to change, what would that be?
I mean, the take-home message, I think, is that we really need to view what happened on the weekend in the context of the kind of sweeping expansion and militarisation of Victoria Police and the authorisation of violent policing in Victoria, and to understand and resist the ways that this is really specifically targeted, often at Black and brown communities. And so it's important, and I think it's essential, that we seek redress and accountability in this matter. That's absolutely essential. But we absolutely need to understand that the tactics of terror and brutality used here actually mark the standard operating procedure of these raids, and they're predominantly racialised raids. And so what we're seeing is normal policing on display.
That was Lauren Caulfield from the Police Accountability Project. So it sounds like there is quite a little bit more to potentially happen in this story. All the best, of course, to all of the different people who've been impacted by it. Obviously, it's a story that causes people a huge amount of stress. If you are feeling any pressure as a result of it, get in contact with QLife on 1800 184 527 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. This is The Informer.
You're listening to The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
You are listening to The Informer. It is 21 minutes past seven. And Nick, I believe we have some feedback.
Yes, Toby. Sparky's texted in a very pertinent question. Can we trust the police to police the police?
That's a very good question, Sparky, and hopefully one that will be answered in this review. But I think it's probably fair to say that organisations like the Federation of Community Legal Centres that I spoke to as part of this story probably don't think they're in a good role to police them.
Certainly a complex history.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely there is. So having kind of explored, unfortunately, an example potentially of homophobia, tomorrow is Idaho Hobbit Day, and as part of celebrating and exploring the different ways that different sections of our community are experiencing life and are looking to Idaho Hobbit Day, we've been having a variety of conversations. One I had earlier today was with the fabulous Mama Mish, whose dulcet tones you will know from Trans POV, and I began by asking her, I could list her bio, but it'll just take too long, it'll take the whole show, I began by asking Mama Mish about what Idaho Hobbit Day means to her.
Idaho Hobbit Day is probably one of our busiest days within the wider community, and a day that we all can come together as one community and work together around being allies for each other. A time to sit down and actually, beyond, say, things like, are you okay? We all been asked people, how are you going? But actually taking the time and listening to one another. And, you know, when you bring together different events throughout the year, it's remembering, are we being one community by including everyone in the conversation?
It seemed like in some ways there has been a substantial amount of progress both within the LGBTIQ plus community and within the community in general into becoming more inclusive. Is that a trend that you've seen?
We're seeing it more within, say, corporate spaces. We're seeing it more around, but there's still a lot of work to be done. When you're getting beyond, say, the corporate white-collar spaces and getting into blue-collar, we still have a lot of work to do within that space. That's a space I tend to wander in the most, especially around my work within employment. We still have a lot of ways to go with employment issues when it comes to the trans community. The trans community is still facing at least, five times the amount that the wider general community is facing when it comes to unemployment and underemployment. Within my program, we just sourced funding from Jobs Victoria to go and help with employment issues for trans women, especially. But as a community itself, we really need to be focusing probably beyond the banks and the accounting firms and start looking at the spaces that we're not getting into. Mm.
And can you give us some examples of the kinds of discrimination that you see or have heard about when it comes to workplace discrimination against trans people?
The honest truth here is the discrimination that we face is not necessarily deliberate. There's a lot of education issues that are still going on out there. I just got done doing training myself out in Rosedale with one government department who said that some of the issues they had were basically not understanding the cohorts that they're bringing in, the people applying, and not knowing how to actually integrate them into the community or how to actually have the conversation. So a lot of times it's perceived as transphobia because they're ignoring the issue and saying, no, well, look, I'm not going to address the person. I'm going to, basically ignore it and not have the conversation because then it might go away. There's also them not knowing how to actually engage the wider community and how to actually be attractive to them. So there's a bit of education around that still.
Yeah, right. And what are some areas that you think where we really do need to do some work in terms of trans inclusivity?
Well, one of the biggest things we find, so I've recently been running some focus groups as part of my project with the Victorian government, is understanding the full picture around barriers and challenges. So I've been interviewing everyone from job placement agencies to trans people themselves to just the whole circle. And one of the big things we're facing right now is a lot around social isolation, that people are just too afraid. And people in some ways have just kind of given up because it just becomes too hard. You're looking at one example, which is a very common example, is five trans people living in a home that's two bedroom, one bath. They share a car amongst all of them, and they're putting all of their income together from, say, New Start or any kind of allowances that they get because they can't find full-time employment. So we need to really focus on the social isolation and including everyone within our get-togethers. Yes, it's important to have men's-only spaces and women's-only spaces, but they should be including trans people as well. And the other thing is looking at what peer support services we actually have that exist. Instead of trying to recreate the wheel like I've seen over the past 6 years, we need to actually look at what services we have. So, for example, what I did with Fitted for Work is I looked at a service that was for women, and I said, how can this service meet what I'm trying to do for employment? So everything from outfitting to CV support, things like that. So I basically turned it from being an LGBT issue into a women's issue. So what other services we have out there that are peer support for the wider community, not necessarily LGBT, and how can we make them more inclusive to include people who are really suffering, who are a disadvantaged cohort?
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
There's one group that doesn't celebrate Ida Hoppet Day, and that's the intersex community, for one very simple reason. Ida Hoppet Day is designed to celebrate the day that homosexuality was removed from the DSM, and the intersex community continues to be pathologized and the subject of unnecessary medical interventions. Something I spoke to Tony Briffa, the CEO of Intersex Human Rights Australia, about.
Yes, so the types of things that are happening in Australia today is, for example, little baby girls in Australia are having their clitorises surgically reduced in size if doctors deem them to be too large. Those procedures certainly are not medically required. They can be deferred until the child can provide consent, but they're not waiting. They're just doing these surgeries and they're saying, well, if we do it early enough, the child won't know and they won't be able to remember. Other things that are happening, kids being castrated, so having healthy gonads removed. And there's even cases of young babies being given hormonal injections to make sure that they identify as cisgendered, heteronormative people as they get older. Now, all of these procedures are, without a doubt, conversion therapy. We speak about gay conversion therapy where people are trying to make people ungay. Well, this is trying to make people unintersex. They're trying to remove any attributes that they deem to be, you know, against the stereotype, the heteronormative stereotype, and to make them into what they deem to be stereotypical boys or girls. And it's just not good enough.
Earlier in this election campaign, Equality Australia hosted a digital town hall with all of the major three political parties, where questions regarding their LGBTIQ plus policies were answered. One of those questions related to intersex policies, and I asked Tony how she felt about the different political parties' responses.
Yeah, the Liberals actually bothered. Their response was completely conflating. They got mixed up between intersex and trans and was referring to intersex being about gender dysphoria and things like that. So intersex still isn't on the radar for them. It hasn't been ever, and sadly that continues to be the case even at election time. The Labor Party and the Australian Greens, however, have great commitments to intersex people, and Labor are even promising that they will ensure the deferral of non-necessary medical intervention on interests of children. So that would be a wonderful outcome if they are elected and they follow through with their election promise.
I also asked Tony whether there were other policy areas where the intersex community would like to see changes.
Well, that would be the biggest area that we would want to address, and then all other things come along with that, such as funding for peer support groups so that we can support families, we can ensure that families receive the right information, so balanced information about their child's particular intersex variation, put them in contact with not only intersex people but also other families that have had intersex people in their families. So that would be really important. So look, they're the main things for now. But we could talk about things like sport, education. There's all sorts of things that we're places where we are impacted.
That was Tony Briffer from Intersex Human Rights Australia.
This has been The Informer. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and review on iTunes. It helps others to find the show.